The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, I came across a piece of video online which has caused a lot of comment and got some traction in the United States. It's a Chinese-born TikToker known as Grumpy Chinese Guy, and he contrasts how the society in both America and China has benefited or not from the moving of manufacturing to China over approximately the last 40 years. Have a listen to this.
They rob you blind and you thank them for it. That's a tragedy. That's a scam. That's why I'm saying this right now. Americans, you don't need a tariff. You need a revolution. For decades, your government and oligarchs want to ship your job to China. Not for diplomacy, not for peace, but to explore cheap labors. And in the process, they hollow out your middle class, crash your working class, and told you to be proud while they sold your future for profit. And yes, China made money. But we used it to build roads, leave millions out of poverty, fund healthcare, raise living standard. We reinvested in our people. My family also benefited from it. What did your oligarchs do? They bought yachts, private jets, mansions with golf course driveways. They manipulated market, dodged tax, and poured billions into endless wars. And you get stagnated wages, crippling healthcare costs. And flagged wave property made in China while they pick your pocket. For 40 years, both China and the United States benefit from the trade, the manufacturing, but only one of us use that wealth to build. This isn't China's fault. This is yours. You let this happen. You let the oligarchs feed your lies. Now they blame China for a mess they made. I don't think so. I don't think you need another tariff. You need to wake up.
So, interesting analysis from the grumpy Chinese guy on TikTok talking about how America has used the wealth it accumulated on the basis of cheap manufacturing in China to line the pockets of what he called the oligarchs, the rich people, while crushing the working class, whereas China built the roads, the bridges, the technology, education and health. But is that just grumpy Chinese guy sounding off, or is there some truth to it? Well, to examine the way in which the influx of manufacturing to China has changed Chinese society and to look in the mirror at what happened in the United States, I was about to be joined by Dr. Wei Jia, who's a senior research fellow on China at Chatham House, hoping to get her back in a moment. I'm not sure whether we have her. Dr. Wei Jia, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. You do have me. For some reason, I don't know why my line dropped.
Okay, it dropped. Now, yes. The thesis from this grumpy Chinese guy, yes, as he mm-hmm. is characterized, how true is it?
Well, I think there's a partial truth, obviously, when he said about lifting millions of people out of poverty and building bridges and railways and so on and so forth. But I think there's also to do with the scale of the Chinese economy. So I think the commentator in the TikTok video, basically, he probably ignored the size of the Chinese economy that actually generated the entire economic growth. The story that we're all familiar with was the double-digit growth in the past decades or so.
Now, the way the society in China has been enriched, I suppose, not everyone is rich in the rural parts. There are many poor people. There are people in manufacturing jobs probably not paid as much as they should be. But would you say it's generally true that more Chinese people are better off than they would have been two decades ago?
Well, I think really judging from when Xi Jinping came to power back to 12 years ago or so, I think many of the microeconomic policy has really pivoted into lower to middle income group and hence made those particular income groups that really benefited compared with for those who live in the coastal area. But I think the challenge also remains as the country is deeply divided by this so-called Hukou Registration Forum. That is to say, much of the social welfare resources being largely concentrated in the coastal area has not really been shifted into the rural area. So I think that's where the inequality line draws in here.
Now, in terms of healthcare, in terms of education, how has the picture in China changed?
Well, again, I think obviously you do have the social welfare for all, but I think it's really largely depends on where do you live. If you live in a relatively wealthy area and the social care was much better than for those who, like, for example, live in the inland provinces. So I think these are the differences, and we have not really factored in. By having manufacturing sector in those provinces, they obviously bring up the GDP number, but this not necessarily translated into that improvement of the social welfare. So it's a very varied picture in here.
Now, the point being made by the grumpy Chinese man was about wages in the United States stagnating. And it's interesting that the official federal minimum wage in the United States is still down around $7.50 an hour. And it hasn't improved in the last decade or so. In fact, it had a peak of $12.50 an hour way back in 1968. So for the people at the lower end of the spectrum, they're poorer probably in real terms in the United States than they ever were.
Well, that's probably true, but I think this also equally applies to China as well. I think recently the Chinese government talked about that the unnecessary competition among the manufacturing sectors. So they have now used the terms of so-called involution. So what the government now is trying to prevent is preventing that sense of unnecessary competition happen among the provinces, which would further reduce the level of salaries for the manufacturing workers, reduce the incomes of those households. So I think both countries are now down a very similar path.
So do you think the Chinese government is now trying to force down industrial wages?
Well, not necessarily. I don't think it's a force down. As I said earlier, it's the scale of the economy has been enormous, and hence you have various manufacturing competing for different sectors. So I think really we'll have to wait until those sectors being consolidated and to have some sense of like reorganization. But I think we're now in that very painful process of reorganization.
Now, I was looking at a website last night called Machine Eye, and it had a feature on what they called China's insane mega projects, engineering projects, which are truly astonishing. And I also learned that, you know, they're building out high-speed rail at an incredible pace so that you can travel thousands of miles by rail in one day, which is not possible in the United States, where the infrastructure, looking at another report there from the American Society of Civil Engineers, the infrastructure is crumbling, really.
Well, I think really for any manufacturing hub, like what China intends to become already, as it is a global manufacturing powerhouse, and what the basic requirement would be a consistent infrastructure, which is something that United States do not have and India does not have. So I think this is actually putting China in a much better advantage, consistent, continue to producing that level, the volume of manufacturing. But whether those volumes of manufacturing can be consumed by the rest of the world, then that would be another question about this trade dispute between China, United States, and also the trade dispute between China and Europe.
Now, is it fair to say then, as that TikToker said, that what China has done is use the money, and it made a lot of money by manufacturing cheaply for the rest of the world. It's used that money on basically projects that benefit its own population, and indeed they've invested in other parts of the world where, as we know, the United States is pulling out.
Well, to a large scale, yes. That's basically China's pathway to become richer in the last four decades or so. So I think what Beijing is trying to do when it comes to development to the non-Western countries is essentially helping those countries building roads and railways, which largely been absent by United States and Europe. So that is one way they have managed it. But I think on the other hand, this also comes into the sense that whether such an infrastructure is actually needed in those destination countries, that would be a question mark. For example, some high-speed railways in Indonesia, and half of time the train were empty. So that perhaps when it comes to utility, when it comes to economic efficiency, and that need to be analyzed in a greater detail.
Now, the level of education that's available to most Chinese people, is it expected that most people in the cities, for example, would attend university?
Well, not just in the city, but I think it's also in the rural area. So basically university for all. I mean, that has been the wave of university expansion, I think, from early 1990 and I think up until now. But I think the problem is also arise from the question that the country producing far too many university undergraduate students, and hence they would have a difficulties to finding a proper job. So in a way, when I look into the numbers to the university entrance exam for this year, actually the number came down, not necessarily increasing.
The question of when real innovation starts, looking at those mega engineering projects, which are completely designed and fulfilled by Chinese engineers, there was a time when China, like Japan, probably 50 years ago, was accused of just copying and not innovating. But looking at these projects, it would appear that China is now the great innovator in the world.
Well, again, I think, as I said earlier, it's the scale of economy. It's the scale that the numbers of engineers that is available in a certain sector, and government also willing to spend the state funding to creating some sort of indigenous innovation. And hence that, you have the result of the DeepSeek. You have the result of EV batteries. So I think that's really the long process that Beijing has been invested in the past decade, and then lead with the result what we have today.
Is it the fact that China is a single-party state that allows the continuity of policies that will accomplish these tremendous engineering feats?
Well, it's not necessarily about single-party state. I think Singapore is a single-party state. It did not necessarily generate a similar result as China. I think this is what to do with the state planning. That is also to do with the societal perception. Because obviously in China, by being an engineer is a quite respectable job. Whereas if you talk about this, like, for example, in the UK, by being engineering, something that the population wouldn't have a grasp of it. So I think this is the societal mentality difference that led into the result, what we have today.
Again, going back to that comparison being made by the grumpy Chinese man, that in a sense, the lot of the ordinary working person has not improved. The rich get richer in the United States. I mean, there's a stat that says in 1963, the richest people had wealth 36 times greater than the middle income people. Now it's about 75 times the wealth. So the rich keep getting richer by comparison with the rest. So in other words, money is being concentrated in the hands of the few. And the question is, what are the few doing with that money? Is it for the good of society or simply for their own lifestyles?
Well, I think for many of Americans, if you look what happened in how the city looks like in New York and how the city looks like in Deep South, are hugely different. So, I mean, that in a way explains why the Gini coefficient, which is the proportion between the rich and poor, has been much wider than previously. So I think that's America's problem. But equally, that is now becoming China's problem and China's challenge as well, by having that very high Gini coefficient between the rich and poor.
I thought that the Communist Party would probably keep an eye on that and allow people to become rich, but not too rich.
Well, they did introduce the so-called Common Prosperity Initiative back to 4 years ago or so. However, I think this really got delayed and watered down because of the COVID issue that arises within the country. And also this actually has discouraged many Chinese entrepreneurs to further invest in manufacture or in many other sectors. So in a way, I think the Chinese government found quite difficult to draw that balance. On the one hand, it wants to have its microeconomic policy pivot into lower to middle income groups, whereas on the other hand, to encourage manufacture, to encourage entrepreneur continue to invest in the economy. So I think that fine balance that need to require to draw, I think this is really a challenge for both the developed economy like in the West, but equally for the size of economy like China.
Now, you mentioned battery technology and EVs and all the rest of it. And China is now managing to produce cars of a quality similar to those being produced in Europe and better than the quality that's being produced in the United States. And at an incredibly low price. I mean, even if Trump adds 100% tariffs on some of the EVs, they will be competitive in terms of luxury and price with the American brands.
Well, it is indeed competitive. However, I think the the Chinese manufacturer have never really aiming at U.S. market when it comes to the EV export. I think partially this is to do with the geopolitics, to do with the difficult relationship between the two countries. So instead, I think the focus has been remained within Europe, but also to the rest of the world. Now, I think China not only having a trade dispute with the United States, but equally having a trade dispute with European Union at the same time. So where to put in those electric vehicles? And that would be a headache for the government at the same time.
So manufacturing is, of course, roaring ahead of these vehicles. But the question is, where will they find a market?
Well, where to find the demand, essentially, if the domestic demand has been very weak and hence you're looking for alternative market. But where are those alternative market can replace both United States and European Union added together? So I think that's the challenge.
Finally, when you look at the various global charts and you see where America stands, it's number one in one particular area, and that is military spending. China does spend on its military, but it's instead, if you look at another table, the biggest, it is the wealthiest trading nation in the world.
Yes, it is. I think this is also partially to do with that China's particular economic model is largely run by export. So that is part of the reason. But I think when it comes to the military spending, China is catching up, but it's very much in line with its inflation target. But partially that is also to do with the presidency's idea of establishing world modernized army that is able, have the capability to be able to fight. So I think that's also part of the reason why they're willing to spend on military at the same time.
Now, one of the miracles, I suppose, of China is that for such a large territory with such a huge population that they have managed in recent decades to maintain a political stability. Is that political stability threatened in any way?
Well, not necessarily. I think the political stability or the social contract in more academic terms really come with that the party will have to provide a continuous rising living standard of the population. And I think that social contract hasn't changed, I think, ever since 1979. So far, if that would remain to be the case, I think the stability will continue.
All right, on that note, thank you very much, Dr. Weijia, Senior Research Fellow on China at Chatham House. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.